international pressure exerted on Israel, on the one hand, and on the other hand, unless they did something on their own, that is to say, took their fate into their own hands, this occupation would go on through eternity.
You're listening to Norman Finkelstein, A Brief History of the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
And so in December 7th, 1987, a nonviolent civil revolt erupted first in Gaza, and then that civil revolt quickly spread to the West Bank, and that came to be called the First Intifada. Israel was determined to crush that revolt and brought to bear massive force. The defense minister at the time, Yitzhak Rabin, formulated the slogan under the aegis of which Israel carried out its massive repression. He called for the use of, and now I'm quoting the phrase, force, might, and beatings to repress this civil, nonviolent revolt. The fact of the matter is that the Israelis were successful. This isn't the first time in history, obviously, that might triumphed over right. And that eventually led to what came to be called the Oslo Accord. The Oslo Accords were signed in 1993, September 13th, 1993. The essence of the Oslo Accord was that the PLO formally recognized Israel on paper, and the Palestinians got virtually nothing in return. Because they were defeated during the First Intifada, and the victor gets the spoils. What the Palestinians got in return was a promise of something in the future. That was really the essence of it. There was supposed to be a 5-year interim period in which Israel and the Palestine Liberation Organization would find a resolution to the conflict, but that never happened. And Israel was able successfully to recruit the PLO the expression that came to be used as its subcontractor among the Palestinians. The PLO took the perquisites of power, namely the monies, the VIP status, and all the other assorted perquisites of power, and they became what the current term is the Palestinian Authority. And the Palestinian Authority is basically an administrative and police network that acts at Israel's behest. I'll fast forward now to 2006. So far I've talked about the Israel-Arab dimension of the problem, then the Israel-Palestine dimension of the problem, and now I'm going to reduce our scope even more and focus on the Gaza dimension of the problem. In 2006, there were parliamentary elections in the West Bank and Gaza. And the international community, in particular the United States, exhorted all Palestinians to participate in these elections. Two surprising things happened. Number one, Hamas, the Islamic movement, agreed to participate in the elections. Number two, to everybody's surprise, including Hamas won the elections. Jimmy Carter, the former U.S. president, he was one of the eyewitnesses to the elections, and he called them, I'm quoting him now, completely honest and fair elections. Immediately as Hamas won the election, Israel, followed by the U.S. and the EU, imposed a brutal blockade on Gaza. It punished the people of Gaza for electing the wrong party into power. And that's the beginning. You'll often hear about the blockade of Gaza. 2006 marks the beginning of the blockade, and the blockade was imposed because the Palestinian people were told to carry out elections, and they did carry out the elections as they were told to do, but then they elected the wrong party into power. In fact, at the time, Hillary Clinton, the senator from New York, she lamented that the U.S. made a mistake and it didn't rig the election. In any event, after that, Hamas was now in power, a blockade was imposed on Gaza, and Hamas began to undergo what you might call a political evolution. They clearly made statements, including to Jimmy Carter, that they were prepared to negotiate a settlement with Israel on the basis of the terms of international law and UN Resolution 242. Those diplomatic efforts by Hamas reached an impasse because Israel didn't accept the legitimacy of Hamas as a negotiating partner. From there on in, things begin to rapidly deteriorate. Beginning in 2008, the people of Gaza now start to undergo a succession of brutal Israeli massacres. There were several massacres preceding 2008-09. I don't have time to go through all of them in detail, but the first major massacre occurs in 2008. It begins on December 26, 2008, and it lasts until January 17th. It's called Operation Cast Lead. In the course of Operation Cast Lead, Israel killed about 1,200 Gazans, including 350 children. It destroyed approximately 6,300 homes, and it decimated the infrastructure of Gaza. Then there were several other massacres, including on board the humanitarian flotilla, led the flagship of which that was the Mavi Marmara. On May 31st, a humanitarian flotilla was headed to Gaza. It had 10,000 tons of basic necessities for the people of Gaza who were suffering under the inhuman, illegal blockade of Gaza. And the flotilla was attacked under international waters by Israeli commandos, and by the end of the attack, in the dead of night, 8 passengers were killed. Then in 2012, there was another Israeli operation against Gaza called Operation Pillar of Defense. And then in July-August 2014, there was the most savage of the massacres in Gaza. It was called Operation Protective Edge. At the time, the head of state for that particular massacre was Benjamin Netanyahu. Now, today in the New York Times, Benjamin Netanyahu was described as essentially a peacenik who only, in his past, he was only inclined towards what the New York Times called targeted operations. And the New York Times described what happened in 2014, Operation Protective Edge. The New York Times described it as, quote, limited in nature. Well, other people had different opinions of that limited operation. First of all, let me give you the statistics. Israel killed about 2,200 Gazans, of which approximately 550 were children. Israel destroyed 18,000 homes in Gaza. The head of the International Committee of the Red Cross, Peter Maurer, he went to Gaza after the end of the conflict, and he said, and bear in mind, we're talking about the head of the International Committee of the Red Cross, his job description is to visit combat zones. And he said publicly that never in his professional life had he ever witnessed the magnitude of destruction that he saw in Gaza. This is what the New York Times calls an operation that was limited in nature. In the same way, Sarah Roy, the very honorable scholar at Harvard University, she's the daughter of survivors of Auschwitz concentration camp. She's written the definitive economic study of Gaza, the de-development of Gaza. She said she had never seen such economic, psychological, and physical destruction as she witnessed in 2014 with Operation Protective Edge. In 2018, the people of Gaza, they decided to try something new. Many people in the international community had exhorted the people of Gaza, and the Palestinians generally, but the people in Gaza, to try civil disobedience. That armed struggle, as it were, was not yielding any results, so to try civil disobedience. Now, as I've already told you, they tried civil disobedience once during the First Intifada. Now, the people of Gaza, suffering under this blockade, in 2018 tried it again. It was called the Great March of Return. And the Great March of Return, like the First Intifada, started out overwhelmingly nonviolent. The Palestinians attempted nonviolent civil disobedience. And what did Israel do? Well, the record is quite well documented in a UN report and also by Human Rights Watch. The UN report found that Israel was targeting children in the Great March of Return. They were targeting medical personnel. They were targeting journalists. And they were targeting people with physical disabilities, those who participated in the Great March in Return, who were in wheelchairs or on crutches. And the evidence showed that Israeli snipers were overwhelmingly targeting the ankles of the demonstrators so as to inflict permanent life-changing disabilities on them. So, having said that, I suspect there are many Palestinians now who regret what happened on October 7th. So now let's begin with the questions, and hopefully you can organize yourselves, form a line, and query me.
Thanks for the cogent lecture, Dr. Finkelstein. What's your advice for young Americans who want to revive an anti-imperialist movement?
I do feel, just briefly, that your generation, the young people in the audience, is facing three unprecedented challenges, or two of the three are unprecedented. The third one you're facing in the most severe form. Number one, my generation obviously had no awareness of the problem of climate change. So that's new to your generation. Number two, my generation experienced relative economic prosperity for all except maybe 20% of Americans, what came to be called the other America. Your generation, it's just the reverse. 80% of your generation has no future. Your generation has a precarious present and a futureless future. There's about 20% in my generation who didn't experience the prosperity. There's about 20% in your generation that is experiencing the prosperity. So that too is unprecedented. Number three, there's the danger of nuclear conflagration, the annihilation of the planet, not because of climate change, but because of nuclear weapons. And right now, as we speak, there is a very high possibility, I won't call it a high probability, I'm going to say a high possibility, that both in the Ukraine and the current conflict in the Middle East, it will climax in the termination of the human race. So I believe that your generation has very significant challenges that it has to confront if it wants to have any future. On the specific question of what's going on now, I believe the two demands have to be very simple and winnable. And the two demands have to be an immediate ceasefire, number one, and an end to the blockade of Gaza, number two. Those have to be the immediate demands in order to prevent what at this point seems to be a genocidal plan by the state of Israel. All you have to do is connect the two statements that were issued on October 8th. Number one, Prime Minister Netanyahu stated that this was going to be a long war, longer than the previous ones. Now, Operation Protective Edge lasted 51 days. That means, at a bare minimum, we're talking about 51 days plus. Number two, the defense minister stated that no water, electricity, fuel, or food would be admitted to Gaza. If you connect those two statements, it means that the population of Gaza, 2.1 million people, of whom 1 million are children, will not have any access to food, water, electricity, or fuel for a bare minimum of 51 days. And I don't think it can be rationally contested that what Israel announced on October 8th was a plan of genocide. So the two goals have to be immediate ceasefire and the blockade.
What's the best way to understand Hamas?
When Hamas was elected, it was not necessarily because people agreed with its political or ideological orientation. The Palestinian Authority, the successor to the PLO, was riddled with corruption, and the people in the occupied Palestinian territories had grown disaffected from the Palestinian Authority, and they elected Hamas, not, as I said, necessarily because of its ideology or because of its political inclinations, but because it was, relatively speaking, an honest organization. And they ran in apparently a quite honest way a lot of the social institutions in the Gaza Strip, the charitable organizations. And it was on that basis that they won those parliamentary elections. Now, it's also true that they became, over time, very repressive. They had alienated a large part of the Gaza population, and as I understand it, there was also degrees of privilege, economic privilege, that they now enjoyed, which caused resentment among the rest of the population. But the bottom line is, they were never given a chance. And for those of you who know history, that's quite common. When the Popular Unity Government was elected in Chile, it was a socialist coalition led by Salvador Allende. The United States took extreme offense at the result of the election, and Henry Kissinger, who was the Secretary of State at the time, said, quote, "We are going to make the economy scream. We are going to cause so much dissatisfaction that the people of Chile will overthrow the government," which is what they did on September 11th, 1973. The same thing happened with Cuba, with the blockade imposed on Cuba, except in that case, even though they made the economy scream, the government was not overthrown. They did the same thing with Nicaragua, the Sandinistas, and that eventually succeeded. In 1990, the Sandinistas were voted out of power. So that's a very common tactic. The same thing, I should say, happened in Egypt with Morsi. In his election, there was effectively a capital strike in Egypt to destroy the economy and create the discontent, which would then be exploited to eject the Muslim Brotherhood from power in Egypt. So I don't want to pass judgment on Hamas as a government, which is separate from its ideology and its political inclinations. As a government, it was never given a chance. The day after it was elected, the brutal blockade was imposed on Gaza. Also, to say that there are some situations which don't allow for a neat moral resolution. Real life is more complicated in many situations than simple formulas. But I would say the historical judgments are complicated, and I don't want either to speak for Palestinians or to pretend that I know what history's judgment is going to be.
You were just listening to Norman Finkelstein, A Brief History of the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict. He spoke in mid-October. Norman Finkelstein is a distinguished independent scholar and author of many books. He's long focused on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We're an independent progressive nonprofit in our 38th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature voices rarely heard in the corporate media, such as Phyllis Bennis, Arundhati Roy, and Noam Chomsky. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Norman Finkelstein, A Brief History of the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict, and for Noam Chomsky's classic book on the origins of the conflict called Fateful Triangle, just call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. You can order online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us at 1-800-444-1977. كنت غامض عيني وتحني الأحلام. Special thanks to Sat Jolly and the Media Education Foundation. Joichi is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Emil Mathluti singing in Arabic, A Dream.
Racism is an ongoing battle. How will you help?
Teach my children about systemic racism and about historic and persistent colonialism and the responsibility that comes with their privilege. I will use my voice to speak up and I will make more space at the table.
I will continue to educate myself and others in my community about the racism and inequities faced by BIPOC.
We will not be silent and idle.
This message is brought to you by the Canadian Anti-Racism Youth Coalition. Visit caryc.ca for more information about how you can stand up and speak out.
We are diverse, independent, and yours. CJSF 90.1 FM. broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia. From Coast